This is the January 16th, 2019 statutory interpretation class. And what I like to do at the beginning of each substantive class is to take a few minutes to look back at what we talked about in our prior class, just as a way to refresh your recollection, recharge your engines, shout out corrections if I get things wrong. So remember what we talked about in our first class was we did some fundamental discussion about the way you read statutes by using the Parks Safety Act. The idea was not to give you a comprehensive toolkit or to give you materials that you will pull out miraculously in the final exam questions or to use in your bar exam answer. I wanted to just introduce you to the fundamental concept that reading statutes can actually be a slippery process and that there are fundamental philosophical differences in the way you approach them, which can focus on what the text says, which can focus on what the purpose underlying the text of the statute, and how to navigate when the two perhaps are not totally congruent. We then talked a little bit as well about how that interpretive process is molded by your assumptions on the process that generated the statute. We're not trying to do literary criticism by interpreting the meaning of a single author writing a work. We're trying to interpret the purpose and meaning and an application of a document written by a group of people over a period of time with warring interests, potentially. So what this class is going to be about is to take those intuitive concepts and actually flesh out how they turn into the tools you'll need to read statutes and to use them as well in navigating the administrative process. So as a result, as I told you, we have three big blocks in this class. One is legislative purpose. Second is statutory interpretation. The third is regulatory practice. We start our first block today. And now, I want to be perfectly blunt and honest with you. I am not going to try and make this a quick review of political science or to talk about the mechanics of your civics class from high school and college on how the legislative process works. I have a much different purpose with you. What I want to talk with you about is what you need to know about the legislative process for, one, being a lawyer, advocating your client's interest in the legislative process, not necessarily as a lobbyist, but in other ways that you can intervene in the process to shape legislation that moves ahead. You're going to hear echoes of these same sorts of strands of advocacy when we talk about the regulatory process as well. The second is you really need to understand the fundamentals and blocking and tackling of legislation to be able to read the output of that process. So we need, unfortunately, for some of you, I know that reading about this seems kind of dry, a little bit more kind of procedural, but understanding how the House rules work and the Senate rules work and the way legislation works its way through that process actually can shed very clear light on what that language means at the end of the day. So with that in mind, any questions about our first day is worth a discussion? Reactions, philosophical observations? See changes in your approach to life. Okay, so with that, today we are going to not read the standing rules for House procedure or the standing Senate rules. That would be sort of the crunchy traditional way where I would stand with you with a PowerPoint and we'd walk through all the standing rules and talk about how they interact with each other. What we're going to do instead is convey the same information through a historical example. We're going to talk about passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, not necessarily because I expect all of you to become civil rights attorneys by the end of this couple of weeks, but because it's a nice way to encapsulate how the process works and to see the rules by example. So to do that, we are going to talk through asking people to represent parts of the process. So we are going to have one person talk about what happened in the House, one of you talk about what happened in the Senate, and one of you to embody the prestige and power of the White House and the presidency. Now, normally, I would ask for volunteers at this point. It is, and you have to bear with me. I very much prefer to get volunteers. It's the way I've practiced and taught for many years, but I'm trying something different this time. I'm going to call on people to step up in that role. So I'm going to be especially gracious today in the sense of that I know it's only our second day of class, and that the opt-out list is still probably floating around mysteriously somewhere in the classroom. So let me know if you don't feel prepared to take on this role. But what I'd like to do is just using a random calling out process. I need someone to speak for the house. The house, namely, is going to be two different personalities. We'll talk in a second. Is Jackie Riff here? Oh, you! I can't see you behind the peace sign. Hi, Jackie. Could you be the house for us? Thanks so much. I also, while she is doing that, need someone to be thinking about the Senate, where a lot of the real knife work was done. Is Ciara Dodds here? Hi, Ciara. Thank you. Will you be prepared to be the Senate today? Okay, you're representing some very deep South people, you realize. Okay. And then last, fun and an interesting perspective, but may not require to speak as much, the presidency. Isabella Martinez? Where? I'm sorry. I heard a quiet yes. Thank you, Mrs. President. Madam President. Boy, I have to get that one straight. It will happen someday. Okay. So with that in mind, if I could ask Jackie, could you go ahead? Just for, I know a remote possibility that perhaps some members of the class have not yet really absorbed what happened in the House. So can you just give us, first of all, a 10,000-foot overview of what happened in the House when this bill was initially considered?
Sure. Well, the biggest overview is that it passed. But, okay, so
I like that. That is excellent oral advocacy. You tell the answer, then you explain why it's the right one.
Sure. So it was JFK's civil rights bill. So they wanted to introduce it to both the House and the Senate, but they thought that it would have an easier time first getting passed in the House, so they started there. Mm-hmm. And so the House Judiciary Committee, they're the ones who had the jurisdiction for the civil rights bill, so they referred it to the subcommittee that was predominantly civil rights advocates.
Subcommittee of which committee?
Antitrust
matters? Mm-hmm. But that's the subcommittee was antitrust matters. It's a subcommittee of a functionally larger committee. What's the committee that it springs from?
Is it the House Judiciary Committee?
There you go.
Oh, okay.
Why the Judiciary Committee?
They were the ones who had jurisdiction over civil rights bills.
Okay, and how did they have jurisdiction over civil rights bills? Well, I like that answer, but we'll talk about it in a minute. It's actually dictated by the House standing rules. So let's keep going.
And then they marked up the bill, which basically they kind of make some amendments to it. And they were really set on strengthening just about every possible thing that they put in.
Mm-hmm. Why? Doesn't that seem to make the bill harder to pass?
Well, they knew that it would be
okay, so essentially they're bidding high on the rug price, knowing they're going to end up someplace in the middle. Okay, let's keep on.
And then the Southern subcommittee members voted to send the bill straight to the committee where it was marked dead on arrival. And then the president's administration agreed to leak the bill, but the substitute ended up still being stronger than the original bill. So
JFK
was very happy about that.
Okay, and Jack, just to back up a little bit, who pronounced it DOA? I mean, why would we care?
Oh, is it McCulloch?
McCulloch, yes.
McCulloch?
Mm-hmm. And why does his opinion matter? And so, if you don't mind, can I cast about to your co-counsel around the room and see if they can also punt? So, does anyone here know what McCulloch's role is vis-a-vis the committee? Let's make sure we got that straight. Is he chairman or ranking member? What does that mean? And you're giving wonderful answers, but I can barely hear them. So basically, the opposing, the second in command of the committee, effectively, someone who is not the chair, but representing the minority party in the committee. So effectively, the Republicans declared it dead and arrival. Point being that it would not pass unless it had Republican votes and Democratic votes. So this is ultimately, inherently, even at the initial organic committee stage, a collaborative enterprise. So notice that tone does change as we go along the process. So Jack, I'm sorry, I hijacked your conversation, and no disrespect intended. So McCulloch pronounced it DOA. We have a corpse on the table in the committee. This is the full committee, not the subcommittee anymore. So what happens? All right.
Then it moved on to the rules.
So effectively, it's now a JFK GOP bill?
Slightly, but okay. It's kind of starting to change shape a little bit.
All right. And just roughly, this whole process started in June. About what time frame are we up to right about now?
At this point, it's about October.
Okay. So we're looking at least 4 months just to get it out of committee. All right. What happens next? And you're doing a nice, crisp, high-level summary, which is what I asked for. But I also realize we might need to step back a slight bit. What is a rules committee? If you ask a man or a person, gosh, I'd be very sensitive to sexist language now. A person on the street, if you ask them about the legislative process, may have no clue what that is. What is a rules committee? Okay, so basically it dictates the terms of how you will actually discuss the bill, not the substance of the bill. Although, effectively, how the two merge together is an interesting question. And who is the chair of that committee?
Judge Smith?
Mm-hmm. Put it this way, friend or foe for the bill? Okay, very good. All right. So effectively, realize now we're 4 months into the process, and we've only now managed to stumble into the second committee hearing process. So what happened in the Rules Committee?
So they're able to schedule a meeting.
Oh, sorry. What does that mean? Let's begin with the predicate. Judge Smith hates this bill. He wants to drive a stake through its heart and drag it through the public square. So he has the power to do so, being an 80-year-old House representative. You know, he's entrenched like a toad in a log. He can do whatever he wants with any bill that falls within his purview of the committee, absent some potential escape hatches. It sounds like you're about to talk about the three escape hatches.
Right.
Okay, what about the other two, just so we know what they are? And by the way, for those of you who are taking notes and listening, think about the usability of these tools for current, ongoing legislative impasses in our current Congress. Like, for example, what relevance would these tools have for someone who wanted to address the shutdown? Just to make sure this is not just a solely historical exercise. I'm sorry, Jackie, I interrupted you again. You were about to say what were the other two were?
Oh, no, I was just going to talk
about the next two. Okay. Well, just because they didn't work this time doesn't mean we shouldn't know about them.
So it said, first, a petition signed by the majority of the House of Members can remove any bill from committee, including the Rules Committee, after it has been in committee for 30 days. But then it said a representative circulated a discharge petition. So they refused to deliver the signatures that they needed. Another thing that they were
Well, just to make sure we're keeping track. So we have the bill text itself, which came from the president. So this is not written by underpaid staffers sitting late at night in a windowless conference room eating pizza. That, in turn, was referred by the House Speaker to the substantive committee that had jurisdiction. So at the initial substantive jurisdictional committee, which held hearings in a subcommittee that was really dedicated to antitrust, but since Manny Huelar was the head of that committee, he kept it to himself. At that point, it was referred back out, and it had to go to the Rules Committee. What we're talking about right here are three ways to blast it out of the Rules Committee when you have a chairman who normally has the power to kill it dead. And the first one you're talking about, Jackie, is the discharge petition, right? And essentially, what does it take to pass a discharge petition? I mean, who's voting at the committee?
It is the majority of the House members.
So it goes to everybody. You're taking the committee's business out in public to air your laundry, basically. And you can get a majority to pass in favor. You can blast it out of the committee, or at least to hold a hearing in the committee. All right, so the Democrats had the majority here on the House. Why didn't they just solve it that way?
Certain representatives didn't want to sign.
When you say certain representatives, there's some subtext there. I assume that they were Republican, but it had to be more, didn't it?
Yeah, Representative McCulloch and Hallett refused to deliver the needed Republican signatures on the ground that such course was antithetical to the committee process.
Right. So, and just for what it's worth, a discharge petition a lot of times will fail even if the representatives agree with the substance of the bill under consideration because of the desire to preserve the institutional integrity of the committee process. So, no luck with discharge. What was the next one?
Calendar Wednesday.
Ah.
So, the speaker on each Wednesday can call a standing committee's alphabetical order to inquire whether the chairman wishes the House to consider any bill previously reported out of that committee. But with 11 committees coming alphabetically before the Judiciary Committee, the bill's opponents can easily defeat the tactic by calling up other bills to withdraw the individual time.
Okay. So, the order of the committees being called on calendar Wednesday is driven by what?
Alphabetical.
So if we had the Committee of Agriculture, this doesn't apply to us very much. It's just we had the misfortune being referred to the judiciary. Blah. We need more coffee. All right. So this was just essentially pretty easily circumvented. All right. So what's our last option?
It's just to get a majority to vote.
Mm-hmm. Let's just call it the committee rebellion option. All right? Let's call it. All right. So you don't have to curry votes in the entire House. You just need to pick and choose your friends and enemies within the committee itself. So why would that succeed when you couldn't get the House majority to sign on to this? Who betrayed whom? Bless you.
Sorry.
Who betrayed whom?
Who betrayed
whom? In the sense if you're a Republican member of the party at that time. That may not be a fair way to say that. Who told the chair of the committee, the Rules Committee, that they were willing to vote to have that considered by the full committee over his objection? Was it a member of his own party? And I see a few people nodding their heads yes. I'll just simply suggest this. It's rare for this tactic to be tried. It's rare for it to win because it is essentially taking on the head of the committee and they can make your life miserable long term. This is a gutsy call. But if you had enough people on the committee who are willing to back you, you're able to blast it out over the chair's objections. And so reluctantly, the judge did so. So what happened then? So are we done? Okay.
So after that, the bill survived the House Rules Committee, and we didn't even have any amendments, which was great. And then
Well,
we moved to the floor.
Were there hearings before the Rules Committee? So essentially, we had extensive hearings for the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. Here we have this, essentially a motion just to schedule a hearing to potentially get on the calendar. It's not a vote to approve it. So, next step up, hearings. But you're right, the bill largely escaped unscathed at that point. So, now what? I'm sorry, Jackie, I had trouble here. Yeah. All right. So, what happens on the floor? Does everyone raise their hands, say aye or nay, and then go home and have a beer?
So, there are six steps to what happens. So, first, the House debates the bills on the bill of rule.
Mm-hmm.
If the rule is accepted, the body will resolve the committee of the whole of the House, of the whole House on State of the Union, which is the whole House following simplified procedures for purposes of the debate. Members offer amendments, which are debated and then accepted or rejected by the unrecorded votes. The members will then resume sitting formally as the House. If requested by a fifth of the members, they will take recorded votes on any accepted amendments. Then a minority party member will be recognized to offer a motion to recommend the bill to the committee, and then the House will vote on the bill as an amendment.
Okay. And so, thank you. That's a very crisp description. That's 6 points for each of you to know and note and taking notes in this class. Of the six, the bill went through all six of them? That's not a trick question. I'm sorry. It sounded like a trick question. That's why I wanted to warn you about that. It obviously must have if it passed the floor at some point, right? So we had the reading of the bill. We had the submission for the approval of the House rule. We had substantive debate on amendments. Did anything of significance happen to the substance of the act during the unrecorded amendments process?
Yes. So this is where Judge Smith kind of became a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to include sex in one of the in description of what you can't do with your finger on.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he kind of had some less great reasons for doing so, now we're pretty happy about it.
Well. Please share. What are the reasons? I suspect they may become germane when we talk about more things next week.
Well, it seemed like they were talking about was that a lot of Southerners were upset that black people would have equal rights, but white women wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they kind of throw it in there. But I think they thought that would cause more issues, but I guess it didn't because we have it now. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Let's put it this way. There might be some racially tinged motivations, but nonetheless sincere at that time. But also more intriguingly, it's a bill designed to, it's an amendment designed to kill the bill. It's a poison pill. You get it approved with the idea that this means that when it gets to the Senate, it is truly DOA. So when you're interpreting the intent of the statutory language, what does it mean when you have an intent to actually undermine the bill? Anyway, pocket that one away. Think about it. It was approved in an unrecorded voice vote in that amendment process?
Yes.
Okay.
290-130
I'm sorry. Is that on the amendment or on the actual bill?
On the amendment. On the actual bill. No, that was on the actual bill.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know the vote if it was unrecorded?
Because they presumed sitting at the House, and it was only if it was requested that they would record the vote.
Right. So you can, even though it's an unrecorded vote with sparse legislative history, nonetheless create the legislative history by requesting an actual vote, which could take separate forms of a voice vote, a hand vote, a tally vote, whatever. Bottom line, at the end of the day, you end up with actual footprints that show who voted for what and why, even though the original discussion took place off the record. Okay? All right. So are we done? All right. So as far as you're concerned, you're done. When was this actually achieved?
This was February 10th.
February 10th. So how many months are we looking at then?
Five. 8.
Yep. 8 months. All right, just to get through one chamber. And notice, in theory, it could have proceeded through both chambers simultaneously. It could have done to the Senate first as well. These were all driven by strategic and tactical calls, primarily influenced by other legislative debates. Happened at the same time, particularly dealing with tax cut legislation. So there's a weaving through of external forces we're not paying attention to here that drove some of the fundamental strategy calls. All right, but you've done your work. Now you do get to go out and have the beer and relax. All right, so that then brings us up to the Senate. Are you ready to dive in? All right, are you guys excited to get this bill?
No.
Okay. Well, I guess I want to begin by with one sort of general question. This is in early February 1964. What happened in November of 1963? Isabella, do you know what happened in 1963 November? You were killed. I'm terribly sorry to convey the news to you. Now, I wanted to mention that because, remember, her administration drafted the original bill. Robert F. Kennedy, as we all know, was Attorney General at the time, put enormous logistical and tactical resources at the disposal of the House floor managers to get that legislation passed. So you're dealing with a wholly new party right now. Have you had a chance to marinate the history of LBJ by any chance? Lyndon Baines Johnson, Master of the Senate. If y'all have a chance, Robert Caro's biography is well worth a read. LBJ, our Texas president before the George H.W. and George W. Bushes. I'll simply say that he was the minority leader in the Senate for a few years, and then became majority leader of the Senate prior to being elevated to the vice president, which meant he knew everything about how things got done in the Senate, including who to manipulate, who to bribe, who to threaten, who to buttonhole. So having LBJ from the Deep South, who was not necessarily viewed as a strong civil rights advocate, who had participated in weakening prior versions of this legislation, in the corner of the Senate when this process began, made you an enormously important player. So keep that in mind as she's describing this process. If you want to jump in and describe what you were doing to try and get this bill passed around that same time frame, that would be helpful because it shows the role of the White House in getting legislation passed before it gets to the White House. All right, so I'm sorry. With all that, we were standing at the gateway to the Senate. We have a freshly baked House bill that's being reintroduced as a Senate bill. What happens?
So the majority leader, Mike Mansfield, his strategy was to avoid referral of that bill to the Judiciary Committee because he would have ignored the bill, and then he wanted to invoke cloture against the Southern filibuster, and then he wanted to pass the bill in form that the House would find acceptable without the need for a conference committee, because at that point, the differences between the House and the Senate version of bills are kind of reconciled, so they want to try and make it like the same language. Mm-hmm. And so that would offer the Southern opponents more opportunities to appeal the bill.
Okay, so that's a good sense of the strategic imperatives driving his decision making. So how does that translate into tactics? What did he do? And you might want to compare it to what he did. How did it vary from the usual run-of-the-mill process? Because he threw some curveballs. There's some unusual stuff here.
So at the very beginning of the debate, when it first arrived, he tried to first get along with the Senate. He had to read it the first time.
Okay.
And he objected.
And just so we can all agree, that's a pretty non-controversial step, right? Okay.
Step two.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so he objected to the second committee
So just to make sure we understand the finesse that's involved here, by objecting to the second reading of the bill, he precluded the Senate from being able to substantively consider it in a way that would trigger a window for filibuster. Essentially, it's just a straight-up delay tactic. Before they could sink their teeth into it, he took it off the table. All right, so he objected, it goes into the freezer, then what?
Mm-hmm. So he moved to have the bill placed directly on the Senate calendar so he could bypass the actual reading.
And this was as part of the second reading of the bill?
Yes.
Okay. So move to add directly to Senate calendar. What would have happened if he hadn't done that? Okay. So effectively, he's doing an end run around the committee system that exactly what got enforced over here, and they tried to do but couldn't. It went straight there. Okay. And the Senate standing rules dictate which substantive committees get hold of a particular bill. So he couldn't control which chairman got hold of it. Okay. So he moves to add it directly to the Senate calendar and short circuit the committee process. What happens? I'm sorry. Which Southern leader?
Richard Russell.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. It's worth for those of you who love personalities. He was actually LBJ's mentor, which creates an interesting dynamic for you. So anyway, let's keep going. Okay. So, and that was about 2 weeks?
Yes.
Okay. All right, then what?
So after that, they selected Senator Hubert Horatio Humphrey in order to lead the debate on the floor because he was a very committed civil rights legislation commissioner, I guess.
That is a drastic understatement. The guy, he I'll stop there. I just, as someone who actually saw him towards the end of his political career, he truly was an amazing character in Democratic politics. But he was passionately committed to civil rights. So having said that, they gave it to the one guy they thought had the energy and power and position, because he was also Senate Majority Whip at the time, wasn't he, to actually get it across the finish line. So this is a serious commitment of legislative resources by the Senate Majority Leader to actually get this thing done. All right, let's keep going. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. And he selected a bunch of representatives from each region to inform on the movements of all parts of the party against that. And then on March 9th, the Mansfield moved to make it the pending business of the Senate. So he got withdrawal of filibusters from the Southern conservatives. And for 14 days, the Senate debated just simply the issue about whether to consider the bill at all. And then Mansfield met with the
Sorry, just to make sure. So move to make it the business of the Senate basically means start floor debate. To actually say, we are approving discussion of the bill. We're not talking about the bill, we're talking about whether we're going to talk about the bill. All right, and that triggered a filibuster at that point?
14 days.
14 days. That's pretty minor, isn't it? Okay. Let's just put it here, 14-day filibuster. And how'd that one get busted? I'm sorry, how did that one become over, how was that filibuster overcome? Okay, so just to make sure we've got that clear, one way to bake a filibuster is to make them filibust. They actually have to stand behind the podium and talk continuously as long as physical endurance will allow. And you just say, okay, fine. We'll keep the lights on. We'll see you in the morning. We'll come back with coffee and hopefully you're still going strong, leading to things like Senator Cruz reading Green Eggs and Ham. The point is just to occupy the time. All right, that's one way. And the other way to break it was, there's what procedural motion actually breaks a filibuster?
A cloture.
A cloture. How many votes does that take? And that's a bit of a tricky question, I have to confess, because there's one answer for then and one answer for now. Mm-hmm. But, well, was it 67 at that time, or is it 67 now? Okay. It's at that time. How many votes were required to get the bill out? 67. Currently is not 67. You can actually get 60 votes and break with a cloture vote. So just a small note of importance, because that radically changes the power balance under the current congressional system. But then again, we'll talk about what's happened to the power of the filibuster in recent times next week. All right, so we've actually now had a 14-day filibuster over just the issue of whether or not they're going to have a talk that's going to be filibustered. But it was overcome, they voted it out, and now what? Okay.
He knew that there was another filibuster coming, so he spent 3.5 hours on the 55-page speech. And then he decided to go ahead and take the defense and then hold the floor for another 12 days after that, so that he could try and go a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
So then, after he finished his filibuster, the Southerners kind of dominated the floor after April. So to reach the votes
That's a fairly steep climb, isn't it? All right.
President Johnson helped out here as well. He fed the bipartisan coalition with strategic advice, twisted arms, and offered waffles.
Is that accurate?
He did. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I have to admit, part of me is resisting the temptation to request that you speak with swagger, with a lot of crudity, and a big drawl. The thing about being lobbied by LBJ was he was a man who knew no boundaries. He would grab you by the lapel, pull you up close to his 6'4" frame, look down and say, "I expect your vote, right?" So when LBJ jumps in and puts the full power of the White House behind this legislation, we're talking about swaps to get water projects approved. We're talking about deals to get emergency aid appropriated. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But bottom line at this point, during the filibuster, all this maneuvering was taking place behind the scenes. So eventually it sounds like there's a pressure building up until something gave. What gave? Mm-hmm.
And so,
sorry, why would you care about Dirksen? Who is Dirksen?
He was a senator who represented his position through his ability to kind of turn super conservative Republicans into situations in his favor.
Mm-hmm. So, is he just any senator? Does he have a position?
Minority.
Yeah, he's basically the Chuck Schumer of this story. Very different personalities. Don't misread what I just said. But in terms of position, that's his role in this one. Okay.
So he went public with his feelings for the bill, and he said that he expressed doubts about public accommodations for fair employment practices.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the representatives of the NAACP that the accommodations title was not acceptable. And so he also expressed hostility to the sex discrimination provision. But the momentum caused by House passing the bill and also by the increasing public support for the bill, he kind of had to change his
So did he say, gimme, I'll pass whatever you like?
No, he said that he wanted his own conservative stamp on the final product. And he submitted 40 weekly amendments to the bill. And so he was unable to get enough bipartisan support to give it to President Johnson to try and block into a compromise and say that he wasn't going to do it if he didn't get his way. And there are two different accounts as to whether President Johnson said
which is interesting. Why would he choose that? I mean,
because a lot of the Southerners, like she said earlier, that if that was deleted from the bill, then most of them would not have voted for it, because then white women wouldn't have the same rights as white men.
Okay, so Dirksen basically crafted alternative legislation that targeted specific aspects of the original bill. Things such as the inability to demand a quota in hiring practices was one of the things specifically added that was prohibited by the language he added to the statute. So was there a debate to amend the legislation? Was there word crafting? How did his changes get baked back into the legislation? Well, and you're talking about the subtle strategies of arm wrangling. I'm thinking about in terms of legislative procedure. How did they actually introduce Dirksen's rather substantive changes to this bill? Did they have a debate on the floor to amend the bill? Is this something that changed the tenor of what was originally proposed? I mean, what was the vehicle they used? That's true. And then also did in such a way it was a fait accompli, as you were talking about. So what I'm driving at, and I'm not trying to play guess what the professor's thinking, but I wanted to highlight something that is very subtly buried in the text that actually might have some relevance to our discussion later on how to interpret statutes. It was a substitution, effectively. They put an entirely new bill into the gutted shell, the original bill. So that is very common in the Senate, where a lot of times, rather than tweaking it line by line, there you go, you end up just putting in an entirely new bill that incorporates all the changes at one time. So we now have a substitute bill which has the fingerprints of both Dirksen and LBJ and Manny Cuellar before the Senate. And of course, while this is happening, there are Southern senators standing behind the dais, drawling away, eating up all the time of the Senate. So what happens now?
So after that cloture was a possibility to overturn the filibuster that they kind of foresaw. And so President Johnson steps in again, and
I'll stop here. What did you do, sir? And take some joy in it. This is what LBJ lives to do.
So, when the Oklahoma House passed, but I mean, he had to agree to a lot of amendments, and he thought that the bill would be like a major after all these changes.
Okay. So, to get it passed, I mean, effectively, he didn't do anything in the legislative process directly, did he? In the sense that he didn't introduce any additional legislation. He didn't make any motions. He can't. He's outside. Okay, so how did he support it? Did he stand behind the podium in the Rose Garden and say, I support this bill? I'm suggesting, perhaps to hearken back, remember our first class. We actually didn't just talk about one ordinance. We ended up talking about two. Remember that there is not only the Park Safety Act, there is also the Municipal Safety Act, where to make a deal with the mayor, you had a second piece of legislation as backdrop that made it more possible to pass the original legislation that we cared about. Log rolling, swapping favors, doing things that are not actually on the legislative record that's being generated in the House and the Senate, but nonetheless are incredibly important in informing why legislation gets passed and what assumptions were in play. So, yeah, what sort of sweeteners would LBJ toss out there?
So, if you want some of the favors, and one of them was the one with Alaska.
Mm-hmm. The one in Alaska would be the emergency use of Air Force Two and emergency funds after an earthquake. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if I, and I'm sorry for interrupting you so much. I'm just, I get so excited talking about this sort of thing. And by the way, I will try. I've been told I tend to do two things. I talk fast, and I interrupt people when I get excited about things. Don't let me do it to you. Call me on it if I'm doing it. I try not to. But notice what we're talking about. He called in political favors from senators he was in the Senate with while he was a majority leader who he put in positions of power. They owed him. He used the resources of the White House to effectively promote the interest of two Democratic senators in Alaska after the earthquake. And then he also went in there and personally tried to break the understanding that the senators had between the West and the South, where votes for water projects were the currency that paid for votes against civil rights projects. So as a result, all three of those, they share a common characteristic, don't they? They're not anywhere in the legislative record. There is nothing, no footprint, no trace that reflects that these actions by the White House shaped the bill and bought its passage. Nonetheless, they are there. So I invite you to think about when we are going to argue about what statutory text means, what extra statutory, extra materials outside the legislative record might play in trying to understand where that language came from. I'll tell you, there are some folks who think it is absolutely forbidden to ever consider those kinds of information. Other people think that data is perfectly acceptable. You just have to think and talk about why we think it might be relevant in certain cases. All right, so LBJ is out there. He is twisting arms till you hear bones creaking. And so we're getting closer and closer and closer to the magic 67. So now what? Sorry, where did the two-day wait time come from?
Rule 22.
Mm-hmm. Which governs what?
The standing rules of the Senate.
Right. Well, it's part of the standing. It's one of the standing rules of the Senate. The two-day wait period, what are you waiting 2 days after happening? What's the event that triggers the two-day wait period?
After they sign, moving to bring a
cloture
to the debate.
Right. That's the cloture motion. You can't invoke cloture and jump into the fray. There's a cooling off period. The saucer where legislation cools in the Senate. Their rules mandate a 48-hour cooling off period. So we had a 2-day wait period. Then we actually had the cloture vote. And that was, when was that vote? Yeah, the cloture vote. Sorry? June 10th. And what was the vote? Room to spare. I'm sorry, guys in the back row. I know you can't read getting further down here. I just simply wrote cloture vote, June 10th, and I'm just going to put a big check mark. It passed. So now what? Are we done? Right, this is just a slow, painful dying in the trenches, basically. The outcome's already dictated. All right, so then what? And actually, that's true. They did. All right. So we now have a bill that has passed the Senate. Of course, we're not done, are we?
No. And then the bill has to become a law by both chambers of Congress agreeing on the same legislative language of the bill. And so each chamber of Congress would usually have to vote on it twice. Mm-hmm.
Could we add a little bit of nuance? Because you're exactly right, but I want to explain why this was such a death trap. It's the language must be harmonized into a single bill both can pass that looks exactly the same down to the past period. Professor Ray will talk with you all about bicameralism requirements and presentation requirements. But having said that, the writing process is not done by the legislative bodies overall. It's done by a conference committee. So we'll talk about this next week. We're going to get in a little bit more detail about how conference committees are constituted and how they operate. But the bottom line is that the people who are on the committees, the chairs of the committees, the substantive jurisdiction, are on that conference committee. Judge Smith is going to be on that conference committee. There's a good chance that Dirksen was going to be on that conference committee. In other words, conference committee was a very likely place where the bones of this bill would bleach in the sunlight. So as a result, we avoided it, but how did we avoid this fundamental constitutional requirement? Okay, so again, we're working the process over here again. No jurisdictional committee consideration. It went straight to the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee basically said, take it or leave it. We're not going to change a comma. That way, we don't have to have a conference committee to harmonize two different versions because they're exactly the same. And it got reported out by Judge Smith, who of all people we know hated this bill. I shouldn't say that. Originally opposed this bill more implacably than anyone in the House. He agreed to a one-hour debate period and to kick it out without any changes, which kind of shows how much the terrain had changed by the filibuster process. It created a window to alter the fundamental calculus of the politics behind this bill. All right, so Judge Smith reluctantly sends it back to the floor of the House. It has a rule associated with 1 hour worth of debate divided equally among both sides, I assume?
Yes.
So what happens? I have to pause, and this is not a political comment, but I would simply say neutrally, objectively, isn't it strike you as a bit remarkable that Judge Smith got a standing ovation after the bill was approved, and then Manny Cuellar and the Senate, the House, the leaders of the House all got standing ovations for opposing parties for passage of such bitterly contested legislation? I'm not sure you'd have that reciprocating standing ovations today. I say it because I honestly don't know. But I would be a little surprised. So it's now, at this point, past the House. Are we done?
No.
It's like a soap opera. It's a never-ending story. OK?
It has to be signed into law by the president now.
Well, before that. The clerk looks a lot like you guys, who are going to be running across furiously to the other chamber. So panting, gasping for breath, they show up on the other side of the Congress, and then what?
So it says business was suspended so that he could place his signature alongside the...
He? Who's he?
Senator Carl Meade.
Who?
President.
Yeah. Where did he come from? He's not been part of this story at all until now. He just happened to be holding the gavel at that particular moment as this, the Senate pro tem. Yeah, basically he has that capacity. It's not a trick question, it's just a sense of that this system we've described here, as you get towards the end process, gets a little bit more informal. And you have more freedom of play as to who actually authorizes legislation. All right, now we're done, right? I thought we were going to say, no. Now's your moment in the sun. All right. How long did LBJ take to sign this bill? How long did it take for this thing to get from the Senate final written approval of the final legislation to the president's desk where he signed the darn thing? That's the overall process. You're absolutely correct. I mean, let's face it, you can make a human baby in less time. It's probably a terrible analogy. I'm talking about when the Senate was done. How long did it take to get over to the Rose Garden for a signing ceremony?
July 2nd to the 19th.
Yep, but when was the actual final signature on the line?
July 2nd.
Okay, and when was it actually signed? Mm-hmm. So basically, pretty darn fast. And it was a pretty amazing, picture every possible person involved in this sitting behind him as he signed the bill. And now we're done. So take a deep breath. Congratulations. You've done it. You've walked through and experienced vicariously passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act legislation of 1964. Now I'm going to ask you a question I will ask you over and over again in the course of this semester. So what? Why do we care? What is the lesson to extract from this process for you as lawyers going ahead, advocating for your clients, both in court and potentially in the legislative process? Are there any lessons you can extract from this? Well, number one, I will ask you generally, is this a fairly straightforward, simple, and truncated process? No. I'm sorry, I'm doing that terrible thing professors do where they ask a question then answer their own question, but I can't resist. No! This is by design, elaborate, ornate, convoluted, with multiple overlapping jurisdictions. I will unfortunately give you a spoiler alert for next week. It's only gotten worse since then. It is designed to kill legislation. 90% of bills die in the process. That's the way the process is supposed to work. Now, we all know that from high school and college. Here's the spin. You get to play a role in how to decide which 90% die as lawyers. You can advocate and represent clients, and we'll talk about next week how specifically you might be able to do that. But the key thing is that you need to look at this process and look for the pressure points. Where do you think you could step in and try and either get your representative, your senator, or some other stakeholder in the process to make the changes you think need to be made? What are the vulnerable points? Where would you think you'd be most effective? So I'll just throw it open. I don't have hard black and white rules in this respect. My hope is I'm going to try and get someone who actually works in this field to come in with you and share their perspective in practicing this field so you'll be able to ask them about some of this. But in general, what are just some observations you might make as to if you had a client, when would you want them to call you? Okay, as in?
Before it's introduced.
Okay. And I'm sorry, and your name?
Brad.
Brad. Okay, I thought you said Brett, then I thought Brad, and then I said Brad. So I'm sorry I called you a loaf of bread. Okay. Yeah. Like I think I mentioned this last time around, it's like a meteor coming towards the Earth. The more you can get involved early, the slightest changes have bigger impacts by the end of the process. All right. Second, where is this bill most vulnerable? Well, maybe the reverse way to ask that question is, when is it going to be, what sort of forces protect a bill from being meddled with? I might suggest transparency, public scrutiny. So to a certain extent, I say this objectively and with no moral undertone to it at all, but these sorts of things tend to be done more effectively by cover of night, in a process where there's not a record vote, in a process where there's perhaps amendments made to the bill in a markup session that doesn't generate the same sort of public venue or legislative record that you might otherwise have to deal with competing stakeholders. So with that sort of axiom in mind, where would you want to jump in here? Which place of this process has the least public transparency?
The committee process or the subcommittee process.
OK. So basically here. Of course, we didn't have that opportunity over here. OK. Anything else? Put it this way. It might be difficult to do it here, wouldn't it? For those of you in the back of the room, I underlined the floor six-step process in the House. Except, remember, we have the special committee of the whole. Remember, we have a discussion of legislation with amendments made that are not on the record. Now, you can have a force vote later that requires you to say who voted for what amendment, but a debate as to why amendment is offered, the changing of the language of that amendment during the deliberative process, down here in the committee of the whole, there ain't a record. And also to verify Brad's excellent point here, the subcommittee markup process is usually also not on the record. It may be public, but you're not getting a report dictating who changed what, why. Does that make sense for everybody? Okay. Any other observations or suggestions? Because I'm going to charge you with a mission based on what we've talked about today for next week. Let me offer one final point. Earlier is better. That's as early as you can get. The actual drafting process of the bill before it's even introduced. Now that doesn't sound like the inside baseball it might otherwise, because a lot of these bills come back, they're repeat players. They get considered by Congress, rejected, they come back again the next session, over and over again. So you know sometimes which legislation's pending, and you can have a hand in how it's drafted and considered before Congress ever gets its hands on it. So all that's a long way of saying, we'll talk about this next week, you have to have a legislator introduce it, but the legislator doesn't have to write it. And I know many folks and friends in K Street and DC who make their living writing legislation to be provided to staffers to be incorporated into legislation that's ultimately put into a bill. Does that make sense, everyone? Okay, so then with that in mind, I'm going to take a deep breath. I feel like I'm starting to monologue you, which is probably a sign that we need to take a break and head out and enjoy the holiday weekend. So any questions from any of you about the fundamentals of the process, both the way it works normally and the way they hacked it to pass this enormously important legislation? And I'm sorry, what's your name?
John.
Keon?
John.
John, thank you.
The
six steps of the floor are detailed in your book, but they basically deal with the readings of this legislation and then forming the committee of the whole and then having deliberation for markup and then bringing it back into full consideration and then passing. Only certain steps of it are. The actual amendment process by the special committee does not require a vote on the record. So you have the sausage goes in at one end, it comes out the other end different. There's not necessarily footprints as to exactly who and how it got changed. That's why sometimes we have legislation where in language is put in, we have no idea who it came from. But then you can force a vote after the fact. You just don't see what happened inside the black box. All right? Any other questions? That's an excellent question. Thank you, John. All right. Then, for next week, we're going to take the living, breathing historical example, and now we're going to dig into the details a bit more by focusing more specifically on the legislative process. And that means we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about how the committees operate, where the legislation bill language comes from, where the opportunities are for intervening, And then I want to apply it. And apply it in two different ways. So I will warn you, there might be a little bit more lecture than normal for the first part of class on Wednesday of next week. Please don't show up here on Monday. I will not be here on Monday. But one, there's problem, page 80, problem 1-2. It's deceptively simple. Passing a one-sentence bill to revoke the Affordable Care Act. This one, surprisingly, just doesn't seem to ever get old. So we're going to talk a little bit about how to apply the mechanical description of the process in the first part of the chapter to what you would do as counsel to advocate a strategy to get that bill passed or to kill that bill dead. And then second, to wrap up the class, I want to give you a chance to think about this. The big debate taking place right now is whether Title VII and the sex discrimination language that we just talked about, how it got passed, applies to new categories of people. And in particular, there is a five-way circuit split right now on whether or not Title VII's sexual discrimination language can be applied to sexual orientation, including a new decision from the Second Circuit dealing with a gay skydiver who argued that he was fired because he didn't comport with standard stereotypes of masculinity. So here's my suggestion. Take a look at the end of our reading today, which actually is the text of the Civil Rights Act. In particular, read closely the language that prohibits sex discrimination in hiring. Also take a look at the language that carves out an exemption, and this is where Mansfield's language played a big role in the sense of creating bona fide employment qualifications. And then we can talk about whether or not a gay skydiver is covered by the Civil Rights Act, either under the language itself or in the minds of the people who passed it. And as you might expect, the answer suggests itself, but we're worth having a discussion about it. Okay, so with that, last chance before I would say dismiss you into the wilds of freedom, but I know you've got crim law coming up next. Anything else you'd like to kick around or talk about? Okay, then enjoy the MLK holiday. I will circle back with you about whether we can line something up for either on the basis of sex or all the way. And I'll see you guys on Wednesday.